Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by TechNode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPOs. I'm Elliot Zagman, and with me is a man who has been weeping into his glass of vodka and Red Bull ever since hearing that Vic's nightclub is now no more. It's James Hull.
Man, that was a long time ago. Yeah, Vic's and Mix and the little hot dog stands outside. Yeah, okay, those are old memories. Okay, so we gotta do a disclaimer here. Nothing said on this podcast is investment advice, and even if it sounds like advice, it isn't. Don't take it as advice. While we try not to, we and our guests may get their numbers wrong. Also, this podcast is recorded in the past. Today is August 20th, and views expressed here may no longer be relevant. Do your own research.
We're coming to you from the past.
Yeah. So,
For those who did not get that reference, so the Worker Stadium being kind of revamped and in Beijing, and they have demolished or are demolishing much of it. And
the photos are kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole, it's one of those, like a lot of places in Beijing where you have seedy nightclubs or, the Worker Stadium itself, which is a crap stadium. These are places that probably should be demolished and redone. But people like you and me who were there, you know, in our 20s, we maybe have a few good memories there, although.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I feel bad about it being gone. I'm definitely not in tears or weeping or anything. It's actually probably, it's been a long, long time since I've been to that area.
Likewise.
Yeah, so no hard feelings.
Good riddance for the most part. We still have the memories. Anyways, so today we have Kevin Hsu from the Interconnected blog. For those of you who are not familiar with Kevin, if you like this podcast, you absolutely should be familiar with Kevin. He's brilliant. He writes about, he's a tech guy's tech guy, and he writes about the kind of intersection of China and U.S. tech on his blog, in both Chinese and English. So yeah, he is just a really smart guy, a really thoughtful guy, and we are really happy to have him on the podcast. We're going to talk about the cloud business in China, as well as Taiwan semiconductors and all sorts of other things. We're really looking forward to that. But first, it's been a while since we put out a podcast, so we gotta cover a few things. We're going to have we're going to try to have Michael Norris on and do one of our big earnings roundup, because we're getting a lot of earnings calls these days. But first, I want to just cover a few headlines here. One is we had that earlier this year, we had that Wolfpack short report on iQIYI. Now, just recently.
Yeah, that was April 6th. It was right after, like 4 days after Luck and Coffee admitted to sales fraud, admitted to fraud, all sorts of fraud.
And now we've seen their iQIYI stock go down another 18% after the SEC has announced that it's going to launch a fraud investigation into iQIYI. So investors do not seem too happy about that.
Well, actually, iQIYI announced when they announced their earnings a couple days ago, they basically, or a little while ago, they basically said they have this SEC investigation. And interestingly, it says the SEC Division of Enforcement is seeking the production of certain financial and operating records dating from January 1st, 2018, as well as documents related to certain acquisitions and investments that were identified in a report issued by short seller Wolfpack Research in April 2020. And then it says the company is cooperating with the SEC. We cannot predict the timing, outcome, consequences of the investigation, obviously, because that'll be sometime in the future, and we don't know yet. But it's kind of interesting that they're cooperating, and I wonder if this is going to be maybe the first company that the CSRC and the SEC can cooperate and do like a joint investigation on and kind of solve some of those you know, working audit, working paper, you know, in oversight issues that the U.S. regulators have. That would be kind of probably the most
outcome. Very optimistic, James.
Yeah. The most optimistic outcome possible. But yeah, that's it.
We've been trying. I mean, we try to be optimistic since we started this podcast in late 2018. So we haven't had much reason to be optimistic. But I do think that it's hard to know how much of it is just scorched earth, because that seems to have been a lot of what the Trump administration has been doing, at least for the last couple of years, rather than trying to, you know, some sort of kind of more nuanced improvement of things. But I kind of wonder if on China's side right now they're seeing the possibility of a Biden administration coming to power and hoping to build maybe a little goodwill, and then maybe some of these issues could get sorted a little bit. But yeah, well, I really don't know. I think what is quite clear is that markets are getting skittish around this, because, you know, the more that the regulators are kind of breathing down these companies' necks, the more risk there is. And, you know, the more like the likelihood that some of this, some fishy behavior could be snuffed out. So, or could be found out. So
are you referring to VIP shop?
I think that might be part of it. We'll see with that. I really don't know. Yeah. But they also, I mean, they seem to have missed guidance in their earnings, and their CFO is now resigning. So
yeah,
that's another one that we've seen. What is it? They went down, their share price went down something like 25% over a couple of days, and
24.7 over the last couple of days. Pretty rough. But yeah, I mean, the CFO is resigning in November, and they've already started a search process. So, you know, there's another company on our watch list that doesn't have a CFO and hasn't had one, I think, ever since they've been public. We all know that's Pinduoduo. But yeah, hopefully they'll get a CFO and they'll get a replacement and things will be okay. And maybe there's... Yeah, I wonder what the reason behind the guidance is. I haven't looked into the numbers and their earnings call yet, but maybe I'll take a look at that and try to see.
Well, I mean, VIP Shop has been I guess they were one of the early players in the e-commerce space in China to go public. They haven't gone away, but their story hasn't been the kind of growth story that we've seen from, for example, JD or Pinduoduo or any of those. Their market cap is 20 billion, and they've done well over the last, you know, their stock right now, I have a, they've been shooting up,
they've been the target of short sell reports before. They've kind of bounced around. But they went on kind of a margin increasing strategy, and I think it really did benefit them quite a bit. But anyway, what else we got?
Okay, well, I think we recorded a good, I think we have 45 minutes of conversation with Kevin. So you just want to go into that?
At least, yeah. Let's do it.
All right. Here's our interview with Kevin Hsu. Kevin Hsu is the author of Interconnected, a bilingual newsletter on tech, business, geopolitics, and U.S.-China relations. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
It's good to have you on, Kevin.
All right, so like I said, we're gonna talk mainly cloud today, but we're gonna let this this conversation go kind of wherever it leads, because our listeners, if they read Kevin's blog, we know that you are quite well versed and one of the real kind of leading writers out there on the U.S. China tech space. So when it comes to the cloud space here in China, for our listeners who might be less familiar, who are the current leaders in China's cloud space, and what are kind of the competitive dynamics, and how are they changing right now?
Sure. So the big dogs that I think people should pay attention to are Alibaba Cloud and Tencent Cloud. So both of these companies, I'm sure, are familiar to your listeners for their consumer applications, but they also have a fairly sizable public cloud business. And the reason why I mentioned those two is not only because they are the top two leaders in terms of market share within China's own cloud market, but they also actually have fairly sizable market share worldwide. So I'm citing a very recent research that was just released earlier this month from Gartner, Gartner being the industry analyst that analyzes a lot of these things. And their research shows that right now, in terms of global market share, Alibaba is number 3 and Tencent is number 5. And just to round out the top 5 is Amazon's AWS, number 1, Microsoft's Azure, number 2, then Alibaba, then Google, then Tencent, then everybody else. And Alibaba is by far the biggest player still inside China, as well as vis-a-vis Tencent. But Tencent is also growing extremely quickly and also putting some serious investment dollars into growing its cloud business. And we can talk about the specific numbers a little bit later. But just to kind of round out the rest of the China market in terms of cloud, Baidu has a fairly sizable cloud business over there. I think they dub it the Baidu AI Cloud because they want to kind of play the AI card a little bit harder. You have Huawei. Huawei has its own cloud platform in China as well as a few other regions around the world. JD.com has its own cloud platform kind of in a similar vein. And one thing that's also perhaps surprising to some people is that AWS, Amazon's cloud, also has a fairly legit business in China as well.
Very interesting. So with all of those different players, I also saw that you wrote I don't know if it was a whole post or if it was one of your summary of articles, but it was mentioning that there might be a kind of a late coming arrival to the cloud space in China. Could you kind of tell us about that and where that background or why, like how that kind of guess came around? Or the forecast? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kind of openly speculated about ByteDance being potentially a late entrant to the cloud game as well. And this is not like completely speculative. The reason why I made that conjecture, if you will, is that they recently acquired one of the earliest kind of Kubernetes container open source cloud startup called CaiCloud or CaiYun. It wasn't like a humongous outcome, I don't think, for pure dollar value, but it was an interesting acquisition because when people think about ByteDance, they think about Toutiao, the news aggregator app, or they think about obviously Douyin or TikTok, and everyone knows TikTok these days for one reason or another. But ByteDance is also investing quite heavily in the B2B space, even though it's a relatively young company, it's already branching out to other growth areas. It has a decent, I think, education vertical. It has a product called Lark, which is a kind of a, I don't want to call it a knockoff because it's actually not, but it's a very similar product to, say, Slack or Microsoft Teams. It's this workplace collaboration app. And based on what I've seen and, you know, heard, it's actually a very well-designed application. And, you know, they're pushing that out in the China market as well as in the US market as well. So that's just like a classic enterprise SaaS product. And acquiring CaiCloud is interesting because it's very much in the infrastructure level of the stack. It's much lower in the system. And of course, they need that just to serve their own existing products on the consumer side. So it's not like they're acquiring another full-fledged public cloud company per se, like a DigitalOcean, for example. But that being said, it looks like they definitely have longer-term ambitions in the B2B space as well. And I just think it will be very interesting to see whether that is part of ByteDance's global ambition or even its China ambition, because it does have very differentiated consumer app, and it will be interesting to see if it could also present a very differentiated cloud offering down the line as well.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought with ByteDance, is that once, I mean, they have so many products that it just kind of makes sense that they would have their own cloud business as well. Because just to have something, you know, on the back end for all of their whole ecosystem, it seems like it would be a natural outgrowth or a natural you know, kind of addition to what they already have. So, but obviously the cloud space is incredibly complex. And it's also something that, because it's kind of on the back end of everything, that you're the average consumer or finance person might not, you know, fully understand all kind of the nuance and segmentation around it. So with these players in China, and also some of these international players as well, what are the different kind of market segments that each one of these companies and these cloud service providers kind of have strengths and weaknesses in? What are their corners of the cloud block in the neighborhood here?
Mm-hmm. It is pretty confusing because it's hard to really differentiate a lot of them. And it's perfectly actually reasonable to conclude that a lot of them are not differentiated at the moment yet. So I don't want to get too nitty gritty into the technical details unless you guys want to. But I do want to break down just what the hell is a cloud exactly when it comes to the business of it. So at the very basic level, it is infrastructure as a service, right? You see the acronym kind of get thrown around, IaaS or IS or something like that. And what that basically means is a set of servers that gives you compute, that gives you data storage, and they're all hooked up with a bunch of network cables. And that capacity is for rent to other people to use. And that is at the very bare minimum what a cloud is. And on top of this infrastructure layer, you also have this other layer called PaaS, or Platform as a Service, which is another kind of a silly acronym, but people like to use it. But that layer is the layer on top of the infrastructure that has the building blocks for any basic digital application. So you can think of that as a database, for example, or a logging service, or some kind of a big data compute or analytical
messaging.
So all these things are... Yeah, a messaging, exactly. And, you know, like, you can get fairly complex in there. And, you know, people start throwing machine learning engines in there as well. But you see these as essentially kind of table stakes for any digital product. Like, any digital project has to have these things, right? And all these big cloud providers offer that just as part of their core service. Now, how do you differentiate them? And I actually like to look at their differentiation from the original business or company out of which they were born, to see which one is actually better at certain workloads or certain applications than others. So kind of take Amazon, for example. It obviously started as an e-commerce company. So did Alibaba, for example. And because of that, their cloud application or their cloud offering is very, very stable. It's very, very sturdy. And it's very good at providing high availability for their users, because their own business as an online platform has to be that way. If you can't have an e-commerce platform that's serving the world and also has a two-hour downtime every night to like do maintenance or whatever, because that is real revenue being lost. So they're extremely good at that. And Google's cloud is trying to differentiate along AI, because Google is essentially a very strong artificial intelligence company. All of its research, whether it's Google Brain or obviously like TensorFlow and all these other AI-driven engines, and they even have their own hardware called Tensor Processing Unit or TPU, they're all geared towards Google's other AI ambitions, and they are kind of packaging them and repurposing them in a way into their cloud platform, GCP, Google Cloud Platform, to be sold to their end customers for their cloud. And that's kind of how you proxy which cloud should be good at what. And depending on what your needs are as a business, you should be able to pick and choose which one is the best fit for you. And just kind of closing out this thought with the ByteDance speculation that we talked about will be really cool for a ByteDance cloud, given it's so good at processing visual workloads, you know, computer vision and all the search around just being able to drive this very massive short video app for entertainment, is that they could be very well the leader for processing, you know, some kind of very video-centric or visual-centric or live stream-centric cloud, right? Which I think could be very much a trend that we will see more and more with COVID and work from home and all this other stuff.
That's really interesting. Is there any platforms that are offering anything like that yet, or would that be kind of new space for them?
I don't think there's any existing cloud platform that tries to differentiate itself on live streaming or visual processing per se. I think they all have decent computer vision engines, for example, as part of their AI packaging. Since this is the, China Tech Investor podcast, I do want to kind of give shout out to one interesting Chinese company that recently IPO'd on the NASDAQ, which is Agora.
API.
And it's API, which is stock ticker, which first of all, just like hell of a grab on the API ticker.
Yeah.
Good job. Good job on that one, Agora team.
Amazing that it's taken that long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? I was like, nobody got API before this company. But also their whole platform is enabling visual video live stream as an API for people to spin up visual applications very, very quickly and easily, right? So they're kind of compared with Twilio sometimes, which I think is a bit of like an intellectually lazy way to think about it, because Twilio really started with text, which is a very different way to communicate. But Agora just has been video and visual from the get-go.
It's pretty remarkable. The way that you describe this is how the company's core business reflects their cloud business, right? You talked about Amazon, because they built their cloud business around their, logistics and e-commerce business, then that's kind of what it's built for. With ByteDance, you're talking about that as they build their cloud infrastructure, a lot of that is going to be around things like live streaming and video content, right? As it does seem like, especially if you look at, for example, Tencent and Alibaba, these investment empires around, whether it's Alibaba, it's, obviously e-commerce, Tencent, things like gaming, right? How these are kind of virtuous cycles. You invest in Tencent invests in a gaming company, and then their cloud business also can support the gaming company that they invest in. Alibaba invests in a logistics company, and their cloud services can support that. So it does seem like it is it has this sort of kind of virtuous cycle effect where one part of their business can support the other. It's quite interesting. So
yeah.
When we look kind of internationally, you mentioned that, particularly with Alibaba and Tencent, that they've had a lot of international growth. Who has had success in what international areas thus far? And, like everything when it comes to U.S.-China tech right now, it's the question is, what markets will these companies be allowed in the future? Can they continue to pursue the growth where they've been pursuing it? And, Mike Pompeo introduced this kind of this clean network that's like, 30 different countries that are, basically the idea is to kind of keep China out. So what is that going to mean for companies like Tencent or Alibaba or Baidu, these Chinese companies that really have a lot of ambitions in cloud?
Right. So I'm glad you mentioned that topic, because literally earlier today, I was writing my new post that's called Where Can the Chinese Internet Go? Which will probably be published by the time this episode hits the stream. So I want to kind of give a recap as to which Chinese cloud vendors are getting some traction internationally. Alibaba, obviously, like I mentioned, has significant international market share outside of China. Alibaba actually tried very hard to have a legit U.S. Cloud business, I think from probably 2015 to 2018, but more or less exited the market in 2018 when the political tension was getting at the time, and obviously is significantly worse currently. So that's number one. Tencent also has some pretty good business, I think, around the world, though I haven't seen a whole lot of them in the United States particularly. And the reason why the United States is important is because it is still by far the biggest enterprise spending economy. And that's where you look at for the money, right? It's very different, I think, in a sense from looking at a consumer application where it makes sense for, say, a ByteDance to expand into India because of all the population there, even though the spending power there really isn't that strong at the moment. But for enterprise businesses, certainly for cloud, you kind of have to go where the money is currently. Otherwise, you're not going to really make a dent in terms of your revenue. Now, that being said, having the U.S. essentially being shut out for all these Chinese tech cloud vendors, I do think there are a few places that they can go and a few places that they have been going to. One is the Southeast Asia region, and both Alibaba and Tencent and other Chinese tech companies have pretty strong inroads in that region already through acquisition, strategic investment, and a few of the marquee players are already using these Chinese or China-provided cloud platforms. I think Shopee, which is an e-commerce platform out of Singapore, is a pretty good example. They started out using Tencent, but Tencent was also a big investor originally. So kind of going back to what you're saying, this virtuous cycle kind of plays out in different places as well. I think another company, I believe, is Gojek, which is, oh, actually, no, Tokopedia, which is the e-commerce company out of Indonesia, uses Alibaba Cloud as well. So this is one region where they can and should keep on spending their new investment dollar. Another region is probably Latin America. I think it's a relatively untapped region as far as cloud is concerned. It's supposed to be one of the fastest growing cloud market as well in the next 5 years. And there's relatively little political resistance over there. So it's kind of a blank slate if you want to expand your actual data center, your infrastructure, all your construction in that continent. And the last region I will mention is the Middle East, which I think is an interesting pocket of the world when it comes to the internet economy is concerned. Middle East includes Israel, includes the Arab world, and Israel has a very, very strong tech scene. I think it sports like 6 or 7 unicorns at the moment already. Very strong enterprise technology talent over there. And I think last year we saw the acquisition of Careem, which is the Middle East Uber super app. They do ride sharing, they do payment, they do like food delivery. So it's very much more like a Chinese type super app as well. And Uber bought them for like $3 billion or something last year. So they have some really interesting companies. And you can serve these companies really well by just the current existing data centers that both Alibaba and Tencent already built in India, probably to support some of their India ambition, but that obviously isn't turning out so well currently. So maybe that will be put on hold. I would put India in the bucket too, but right now with the kind of the animosity over there, maybe in the short term that wouldn't happen, but you can still use those data centers to kind of serve literally along the longitude of the map, for Middle East customers. So those are the three region I will like to highlight. And coming back to the clean network initiative from the State Department, there's just not a whole lot of details around the 5 components that Secretary Pompeo has mentioned right now. And it took a quick look of also the clean telcos that they sort of presented as the country or the company that are already clean, quote unquote, by U.S. standards. And they cover some interesting countries, right? Like Japan, South Korea, France, etc. So if you proxy it from the clean telco list, you can probably deduce that those regions may be tough for Chinese cloud providers to get into at the moment. But to what extent is that initiative going to be executed on? It kind of depends on, honestly, technical practicality, right? I think there's a lot of proclamation in that, but I don't think the State Department has really thought through exactly how they want to enforce it, if they even bother wanting to enforce it, because deleting an app out of the App Store and like gutting a data center or preventing people from using a data center and even ripping out an undersea cable, which is another part of the clean network proclamation, they're all pretty different problems to tackle. And I don't know exactly what they're trying to do with that other than to obviously make a big kind of statement that Chinese tech is dirty, which is kind of the implication.
Yeah, yeah. The whole like clean terminology, I felt kind of, you know, it doesn't make me feel good. Like it's kind of cringy, you know?
Yeah, it's a little bit icky.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, do we want to use that language? One thing that I've thought about with this is that we have, you know, there's the question of how does it all happen, right? So if you're actually going to try to put together something like this clean network. But the other side of it is that, you know, even if it's hard for them to actually go forward with everything or they can't enforce it, what it does end up doing is it stymies investment into some of these areas, right?
So increases uncertainty.
Would Alibaba continue to want to invest in growth in Europe? You know, if that's a possibility. I think that's where, you know, it really has an effect in that it doesn't make, you know, companies are far more hesitant to take the risks and make the investments to move into some of these areas.
Yeah, yeah. Data centers aren't really cheap things to put together. And I think you make your money back over, you know, quite a bit of time, unless you're using the infrastructure as well at the same time. But yeah, and this whole thing is kind of gaining steam, it seems like. Like I just read Tim Wu wrote a op-ed in the New York Times, which was kind of talking about banning TikTok and that he's sort of supports it and it's long overdue. You know, he kind of talked on it, and we talked about this when we talked with Dev about India, you know, kind of like if US firms don't have access to China's market, it's kind of unfair to give Chinese firms access to the US market or unfettered. And it's kind of interesting because, Kevin, you mentioned that AWS actually has a pretty good business in China. I'm wondering kind of how that's going and if you know anything about that, if it's slowed down or if it's still going well. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I don't have any late kind of breaking information on AWS's business in China other than to just say it's like the whole cloud business is very, very global by default because there's this interesting assumption that when we as everyday consumers use stuff in our phone, you know, we connect to the cloud, we upload stuff, this is how we work. There's this very kind of seamless experience to it. But at the end of the day, they're all still operated and processed by physical infrastructures, and their locations matter a lot, especially when it comes to local data sovereignty, for example, or local data governance. That's kind of how you, at the end of the day, enforce things like a GDPR or anything that's similar that we may have in the US, or certainly, you know, there's a lot of data sovereignty requirements in China, right? And with regard to AWS, you know, they certainly do business for perhaps their non-Chinese customers who still want to serve CDN stuff up, type, whether it's a website or an app or whatever, CDN, exactly, inside China. And there's a lot of Chinese companies, and some of them are even probably like state-owned enterprises, who have a lot of interest in serving up content and stuff outside of China, even though some of the stuff might even be ironically blocked within China. And that requires using some kind of cloud service that has physical data center presence to link all that stuff up around the world, which AWS and many others would be good, resources for that. So that's kind of how I would think about it from that angle. And I kind of want to double click on the Tim Wu op-ed that you mentioned as well with regard to this shifting in narrative about the TikTok ban. It really started with a national security reasoning, without a whole lot of detail, but that was the reasoning. And now you're getting a lot of people trying to justify the ban with a market access argument, essentially, right? Like if we can't go to them, they can come to us, which is, in my opinion, sort of shifting the goalposts a little bit. And just to be clear, I don't really give a shit if TikTok gets banned for me personally. Like my daily food coma is going to be a little less entertaining and I will be a little bit bummed about it. But life is going to go on for me. But what I find the whole discussion kind of missing the point is that what is the justification? And if that is the justification that we as Americans and we as the American regulators are going for, let's just say national security being the justification, then I just want to see proofs that there is things that are being done nefariously. And, you know, coming back to the cloud discussion, they are pretty, they're like relatively straightforward ways you can do that. I wrote it in a recent post. I think it's called like a framework to, you know, distrust and verify TikTok, right? And one of the distrusts that we have about TikTok, it's just that it could be sending information and data that they are gathering from American users back to China, in servers in China, and then, you know, the Chinese government going to do terrible things with it. All right, so if that is going to happen, let's see, or let's figure out how we can verify it. Well, it just so happens that TikTok uses AWS and Google Cloud Platform in the United States, and also like another third-party data center provider called DLR, which is just one of like the largest, you know, data center providers. It stores data in the U.S. and it has a backup in the Singapore data center, right? That's what it claims. All right. So if that is indeed happening, then every single data center, every single cloud tracks logs of information that are going in and out of the data center. That's just like a table stake feature again. Like, you need to know that for compliance reasons, for charging your client because you get paid for the network bandwidth that you're renting out to your customer. So all this stuff is just being logged anyways. There's no reason why the US government cannot just do this in a way where we say, hey, AWS, GCP, ByteDance, let's cooperate. You're going to fork up your log maybe once a week, maybe even twice a week. I don't know how often you want to do it. And the moment we see a piece of data, a data transfer going from a US data center to a Chinese server or roundabout way through Singapore to China, you're done. You're banned. Like, what? That would be a very good way to verify this whole thing as opposed to speculating and guessing about whether TikTok is doing something terrible or not.
Yeah, it definitely has not been a consistent argument or a consistent case or a very, you know, there's the, I think, you know, you mentioned this, I think you mentioned this when you were on Friend of the Pod, Jordan Schneider's podcast, about just kind of the idea of, you know, some sort of procedural justice being applied to all of this. And that is the thing that also makes, I think, me most uncomfortable about, you know, whether it's banning, you know, the kind of aggressive actions taken towards Huawei or, you know, ByteDance, WeChat, whatever, is the fact that it's like, okay, well, what is actually the reasoning behind doing it? But, you know, personally for me, I think that the market access is probably the smartest and, you know, most reasonable approach to take, because it actually, I think, one, it I think it's one that probably is can have the most progress on as well. That I think you know, China in trade talks with China, which are already going on, you know, if you bring up the market access, look at internet from a market access perspective, I think it's the one that I can foresee actually having some sort of kind of positive outcome versus you know, national security or, you know, these ideas of sort of like what an open internet looks like or whatever.
Yeah, and that's a very reasonable conversation you can have at a negotiation table, right? Like, it's everybody knows that no one can really access the Chinese market. It's a relatively it's an interestingly closed economy in one way or another. And we just like, all right, let's just like be fair, you know, like, you can do stuff here, we can do stuff over there, let's let the market compete, let the people decide or whatever, and then we'll just go from there and not have to kind of come up with a national security rationale to blow this whole thing up if really the end goal is just to help Facebook build stuff in China, Google or whoever. Like, if that is the goal, then let's just be like, that's the goal, and that's fine, right?
Yeah. I wonder if they actually want to compete on a level playing field with TikTok, though. But anyway, that's another conversation.
I think Zuckerberg, like, I think he seems more naturally himself playing like the kind of monopolist that he is than I think when he was, you know, a startup, when he was pretending that Facebook was something that it wasn't. I think that he, mm-hmm. you know, like maybe this is just from, you know, watching The Social Network, but I think that he is he seems naturally comfortable being like the big bad guy. I'm projecting my own opinion of him onto him, but that's kind of how I see it. But yeah, he seems to be, I mean, he's cozying up with the Trump administration. It's crazy because he was so, when he was trying to get into China, he was so over the top in how he, you know, he had the governance of China on his desk, you know, and he asked Xi Jinping to name his daughter, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it just seems...
None of it worked.
Jogging across Tiananmen Square.
Yeah. But he's so... I mean, like, I think he naturally is kind of more of a cynical person, you know? He seems to be... You don't get to where you are unless you're, you know, not incredibly ambitious and a little Machiavellian. And I think that's kind of how he is. And I think what he's starting to do is kind of embrace that. And, you know, obviously he doesn't seem like a great guy, but I think it at least is a little more, transparently, you know, evil. I don't know if evil is the right word.
Right. I mean, just to put it like bit of a speculation, but I think there's some reasoning to it too, with this whole TikTok being possibly acquired by Microsoft thing and tying that to Zuckerberg's very ambitious personality. I mean, I think a lot of people don't remember this, but Microsoft was one of the earliest strategic investors of Facebook pre-IPO.
Really?
Yeah. This is, it's stuff that you can just, like, find on the internet. But they bought, a reasonably small stake for a lot of money. It was, like, $300-something million dollars. Don't quote me on it. But it's something in that range before Facebook went IPO. So if you want to play some big long-term chess game or palace intrigue into this discussion, why the hell would Microsoft even care about buying TikTok if maybe it wasn't to help Mark and just run it to the ground and let Instagram Reels take
wow.
over?
Wow.
I mean, what does Microsoft have to offer to run a incredibly dynamic consumer application? It has absolutely zero experience in terms of running a product like that. I mean, you can put Xbox in there.
Well, LinkedIn. I mean,
yes, LinkedIn.
Minecraft.
Acquisition, right?
Yeah.
Minecraft, exactly. And so, I mean, that's just kind of the stuff that if you really put it all together, interconnectedly, perhaps, no plug intended, there's just a lot going on there that I guess a lot of people don't see or don't want to see.
I wonder if there's a political kind of election aspect to it, because I feel like a lot of, like, the last few elections in the U.S., like, Facebook and social media did play a pretty... you know, big part in terms of kind of getting people motivated, whether that's with true or not true information or whatever. But I think there might be some angle there. I haven't, this is not something I'm looking into at all, but I thought maybe that's something interesting.
Well, I think that if they really want to, you know, run TikTok into the ground, I think that Twitter would be,
Yeah, Vine, they have experience with it.
Exactly. They have experience running, you know, good video apps into the ground.
They've done it before.
Anyways.
Twitter's too poor, right? Their valuation is lower than TikTok.
Yeah.
Maybe Square.
Yeah, maybe Square.
Well, Square's been killing it. Square, oh my goodness.
Well, the latest rumor is Oracle, so take that one.
Yeah, that's never happened. I mean, come on. That's even crazier.
Anyways, Kevin, you can put your hat in the ring? Is you're gonna
if I can like kind of change the topic just a little bit. Another thing I thought was kind of interesting looking through some of your posts, Kevin, is this thing with TSMC and kind of like China hiring some employees and engineers from TSMC and paying them, you know, 2 to 2.5 times what they were making. That seems very interesting to me. I mean, obviously the semiconductor kind of battle is I guess in full force right now. We just saw the administration kind of change their the wording a little bit, making it more difficult for Huawei to get semiconductors, you know, ICs and integrated circuits or whatever from any company, whether it's U.S. or foreign, that's using U.S. technology in the creation of that. So they used to have a back door, but anyway, it's all kind of how do you see this kind of playing out? And do you think, I mean, I also read on Digitimes that some of the HiSilicon, Huawei's HiSilicon company, some of their employees are just quitting and leaving because, I mean, what's going to happen to them? I mean, what's going to happen to their business? How's this going to, have you thought about this at all? And what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So kind of to first talk about TSMC for a bit to give the listener some context. So TSMC is the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer. It is the most advanced chip foundry or semiconductor manufacturing facility. By far at this point, I think the closest competitor is maybe Samsung earlier, maybe just like a month or two ago. Yeah, global, like Intel's earning report showed that it is not doing terribly well on the chip foundry manufacturing front and is sorely behind the TSMC, so much so that its own chips, they have to place like a big order to TSMC to manufacture the thing that they thought they were going to do themselves.
7 nanometer. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So 7 nanometer is the level that they couldn't get to. I think 14 is where Intel is stuck at right now. And based on whichever report you read or believe in, TSMC is manufacturing 5 nanometer density chip at scale right now. So it's a few generations ahead of a lot of people, so much so that it basically manufactures everybody's chips at this point. NVIDIA's, Apple's, obviously Intel, AMD, and it's becoming the single point of concentration for arguably the most important thing that drives the entire world's economy, certainly the digital version of the entire world's economy, right? So that gets a lot of people really scared, depending on how you want to think about it. Now, the piece that you mentioned is interesting because so China obviously is trying to catch up on its own semiconductor manufacturing because of all the sanctions. Huawei basically can't buy chips anymore. Like they're going to run out before the end of this year. This like high silicon, I think it's like the Kirin chips that they've designed for their own smartphone that is actually quite advanced, but they just can't get orders to get any of them anymore. So Huawei's phone is just not going to advance and going to probably start losing market share, which is why, you know, these folks are probably leaving the shop because there's not a whole lot going on anymore. Now, the hiring that you're talking about is interesting on a few angles. So TSMC, a lot of TSMC original core team from like the 80s and the 90s are all leaders in some of the core chip foundry companies in mainland China right now. So the biggest one in China is SMIC that was just, you know, IPO'd on the Star Market in Shanghai. And one of their co-CEOs was one of the core engineers of TSMC, like longtime TSMC veteran. He also did a stint in Samsung, and there's like a bunch of intrigues about he has like allegiance to Taiwan and stuff like that, which I won't get to here. But I wrote a fairly extensive post about it that people can read called like The Nightingales, because that's how TSMC caught up. Now, the other one of TSMC's former CTO, I think it's the company's very first CTO, is now leading one of the other smaller chip foundries based in Wuhan. And that was one of the two firms in that article that reported on that are giving 2 to 2.5x salary increments to kind of poach TSMC engineers across the strait to back to mainland. So they're all kind of run by the same people, if you think about it. And
it's a small world. I mean, the amount of expertise you need to be kind of a semiconductor engineer, I mean, there's so many different areas in the process that each person is like, you know, PhD, beyond PhD kind of knowledge. And they're in their own little sphere, and they have to connect all these spheres together in order to like make a chip. It's like an incredibly complicated stuff.
Yeah. What kind of salaries are these guys getting offered? Like, you'd think that considering how, you know, crucially important this is and how small a group of, you know, kind of a people can actually do it. You mentioned that, you know, they were kind of, some of these engineers are being kind of lured across the strait with, you know, 2x salaries or 2.5 times salaries. Like, what? I'm curious, what does that actually look like numbers-wise?
Yeah, I mean, I unfortunately don't have access to the payroll system at TSMC, or I would tell everybody. but I think, like, another thing, too, is, like, number one, is you're 100% right that the amount of expertise, not just on the technical side, but also from the business operational side, from the manufacturing side, to make a foundry work really well, is incredibly, the number of people who know that and have lived that is incredibly small. And a lot of them just like pass through TSMC. And another thing I want to kind of note real quick is that TSMC itself had a episode in its history that I wrote about, that I just talked about, called the Nightingale Program, right? Where they were catching up to Samsung because they were falling behind themselves as well. And in order to catch up, they rewarded new hires with a 30% increase in base salary and like a 50% bump in dividend payout at the time. This was like 2014 or something like that, to catch up. So this kind of like hardcore incentive package to really accelerate your advancement is kind of a well-trodden path for the TSMC veterans. And they were literally running a 24-hour R&D program, not manufacturing, but R&D, which is why the guys who got the, you know, the graveyard shifts were called the Nightingales.
Ah, that's very interesting. Yeah, it requires insane amounts of human capital as well as just actual capital, because building a foundry and buying the machines that are needed and constructing it, I mean, it's not cheap stuff. This is serious amounts of money. I mean, TSMC, one of the reasons why they're able to stay a leader is they invest billions and billions of dollars in CapEx every year. And it's just, yeah, you know, it that is also kind of part of their competitive advantage, I guess. But yeah, I remember when I first got interested in TSMC, I remember reading that Global Foundry was pulling out of their, it might have been 7-nanometer, kind of even attempt. Like, this was before, you know, anyone had ever made it actually work. They were, everyone's trying, and they pulled out in advance, and TSMC was one of the, obviously, the leaders in that. And I do wonder, like, you know, they say all this stuff is operational. How much are they actually able to produce? Because the key thing is the production. You might be able to produce a lot of chips, but you need them to have a very high kind of, there can't be any, the quality has to be very high. There can't be flaws. So it's,
yeah,
it is
like the yield.
The yield, that's
per
right.
wafer,
that's
right. right? I think yeah. it's like the ratio that people pay attention to has to be very high, and that has to do, I think, both with the technology, like the actual, you know, equipment that you're using, obviously the R&D, but even just like the general cleanliness and the temperature and the condition of the factory. And there's just so many other variables that go into running a very highly productive chip foundry, right? That I think just takes years to hone.
So like one of the things, I mean, I know very little about this, but the little I know, I'm going to say, and I could totally be wrong. So, you know, that there's my disclaimer. But yeah, it's temperature. It's, I mean, they're etching things. They're adding chemicals into an atmosphere, and they're trying to grow like a something, like a form on top of something else. And it's this like layers of growth of like that's chemicals are added to an atmosphere, the temperatures are changing, and you're trying to get something to kind of grow. It's wild stuff.
Like trying to get something to grow? That's how like
kind of crystallize like and create these things. It's like it's so beyond, like when I first heard about this and I saw some people talking about it, it kind of blew my mind, like how difficult it is. It's not just like, okay, you make a little line in a piece of a wafer, and then you fill that up with some metal, and then you kind of put something on top. No, that is definitely not what's happening. You're etching something, and you can't even like drip metal in there small enough. You have to kind of it's crazy. Anyway, nuts. I'm reaching the limit of my knowledge here. So that's it.
It's hard stuff. It's hard and stuff. Just gonna add another layer of complexity to just completely lose your audience. Go I guess for it. Is that you can't even standardize a lot of that stuff. It actually has to be married up to design rules with the chip designers, which are the foundry's customers, right? Like making a batch of NVIDIA chips is gonna be a little bit different right. than AMD's. And, Teslas and whatnot. So there is not like a completely just copy and paste type process either.
There's customization yeah. as well. Right. Yeah. Jeez There's Louise. Yeah. An artisanal aspect.
Right. And that's kind of why when you read that GlobalFoundry piece a while back that I think American tech companies just like lost interest because it wasn't cool back then to do this kind of stuff. You know, like chip manufacturing is for...
Oh, it's lots of money.
Right.
And DRAM, you just lost the margins, just went, it went to commoditization. Yeah. The margins went to nothing. And then, that's kind of what I see at risk happening in this market now. If China's going to dump tons and tons of money, these big funds, 100 billion, whatever funds that are coming in, it's going to take them a long time to get there. They can buy the machinery and they can get all the talent, but it's still, even with all the talent and all the machinery, it still takes, TSMC years to get to, good enough yields that they can say they're producing it, So it's still kind of years away, but maybe 10 years down the road, semiconductors are just like a commodity. And even the newest stuff is just, even cheaper than it is now. And so, yeah, but... What's that going to mean for the margins and how's all that going to work? I don't know.
Anyways, we could talk about this for hours, but we need to let
that's right.
Kevin go because we're at 50 minutes right now. So anyways,
Kevin, we appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. This was a fun conversation. Anything else you guys want to go over before we wrap up?
Well, tell our listeners how they can read your blog, how they can follow you on social media, and anything else that you think they should know.
Great. So you can read my newsletter. It's called Interconnected. It's at interconnected.blog. It's written in both English and Chinese, so it's bilingual. So you can either read one or the other or learn about the one or the other. I think that would be a really fun way to use my content. I publish twice a week, and the Twitter will be the best way to interact with me. I'm at KevinSXU, so Kevin S. XU, that's my full name on Twitter.
Cool. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay, Kevin, thanks for joining us. Thanks again to Kevin Hsu, the author of the Interconnected Bilingual Newsletter on Tech, Business, Geopolitics, and U.S.-China Relations. We also want to remind you all to, speaking of newsletters, go to techno.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech. James, any thoughts on our discussion with Kevin?
Yeah, so I just wanted to kind of go read one paragraph from Tim Wu's piece. Tim Wu is kind of a guy that I've always thought of as an open internet kind of guy and for that sort of thing. So when I read this paragraph particularly, I was kind of shocked, and that's why it kind of stuck to me a little bit. So here it is, Tim Wu. Some think that it is a tragic mistake for the United States to violate the principles of internet openness that were pioneered in this country. But there is also such thing as being a sucker. If China refuses to follow the rules of the open internet, why continue to give it access to internet markets around the world? That's it. So
yeah.
I thought that was quite, anyway, it's from a guy who's, I thought was pretty pro open internet. It's interesting to see that.
Well, this is not the only space where you hear that argument, and I think it's valid in a lot of ways. We'd hear, okay, well, you can't have, if you want to have a tolerant society, you can't really tolerate, extreme intolerant bigots, right? It's if you want to have a basketball team where everyone's passing the ball, right? You can't have, you know, Carmelo Anthony on it. Right? You can't have a ball stopper. You have to have and what it ends up doing is, you know, if you're somebody who actually does want to play by those, I think Adam Grant, the organizational psychologist, right, he, in the book Give and Take, right, he talks about on teams you have what he would call givers and takers, and then you have most people in the middle are kind of matchers who do reciprocal giving and taking. But the people who are looking to, quote-unquote, take, as he would put it, right, or looking to gain the most as they can out of each situation, right, their negative impact is essentially equates the positive impact of three of what he would call givers, right? People who are looking to give or offer what they can in a situation. And I don't know if that's the perfect analogy because, you know, I think the U.S. is often takers in many, many situations as well. But that is, it's that dynamic that I think is at play here, that you can't have a system of openness or, you know, what we would hope the internet would be, right, unless everyone is sort of abiding by the same rules. And hopefully, if we can actually have some sort of productive negotiations between the U.S., China, and other nations as well, we can try to establish some new norms going forward. Yeah. But yeah, we'll see. Okay, anything else you want to say before we wrap things up?
Just that, you know, listeners should look out for an update on earnings. We got a whole lot to talk about. Baidu, iQIYI, JD, Alibaba, and Pinduoduo is coming out soon. So look forward to that.
Yeah, and you can catch us all next time on the China Tech Investor Podcast. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye now.